bit at a time. That's all I'm asking. He'd forgotten she hadn't been fighting for them all these years, just fighting to stay away.
Okay. One step at a time. The first of which is to get you upstairs and into bed.
He had to half carry her up. She didn't seem able to put much weight on the leg at all. He got her into the bedroom.
See? Nothing here. Just a room.
He sat her down on the bed.
Don't bend it, keep it straight.
I don't have any night clothes with me. I didn't think, she said. He opened a drawer, picked out a T-shirt, passed it to her, thinking about the one he kept in the chest at the bottom of the bed, the one she had worn on that very first night.
You get sorted, I'll fetch your antibiotics. You need to take a couple more in a few hours.
Can you help me into the bathroom? Once inside, she locked the door, keeping her eyes firmly focused on the sink, ignoring the personal things that littered the room. She managed to rudimentarily clean her teeth using her finger and wash her face with her hands. The towel smelled of Charlie. The room smelled of Amy. Out on the landing, she gasped for air and limped back to the bedroom, shoulder against the wall for support. She dare not breathe them in and make them a part of herself again. She'd be undone. Charlie was right. The room that was his was a blank canvas, just a room. No ghosts, no fodder for the imagination. She eased herself onto the bed and under the cover, hoping that the bed would smell of washing powder, just like the T-shirt. To her relief, it did. He knocked, surprising her.
Okay,
she called.
It wouldn't have felt right to give him permission to come into his own bedroom. He made her take another handful of tablets.
Any Mogadon in there? She asked in a lame attempt at humour.
Worried you might not sleep.
It was a stupid question. How could she sleep with all that had happened washing around in her head? He sat himself down on the end of the bed and she shifted herself away from him. Only slightly, but enough for him to realize that no bridges had been built yet.
What do you do with yourself? Up in London.
She didn't want to talk about it, really, but it was as hard as ever to refuse him. I walk, mostly. Look at things, hang about in the museums, libraries. I help Diana out at the centre sometimes.
It was an approximation of the truth. She did all of those things. But mostly she studied other people, constantly trying to figure out the traits that made them normal, functional human beings. What she had gathered was that normal people did not live in flats that were like an ark to someone else's past. They did not wear their clothes until they fell apart, or by the first thing that fitted in the first shop they found. They did not live on packet sandwiches and takeaway coffee. They did not avoid eye contact because they were sure that everyone would be able to see their secrets. They did not marry their fathers and bear them children. But then again, their lives were based on some semblance of the truth. Charlie was watching her.
I have to ask. Why did you believe it? Why did you think I would have done such a thing and never told you?
Rachel sighed, massaged her brow with the fingers of her good hand. She could see so much pain in his face.
Why wouldn't I? Is it the kind of thing anyone would lie about?
And would you really have told me you'd slept with my sister? Don't think I haven't been over it a million times. But no one's mother, even a pretend mother, would lie about a thing like that. More specifically, his mother would never lie a thing about that. Valerie might have, but not Delia. Delia cared. Charlie got it. Even now, she still believed that Valerie wouldn't have stooped that low. He supposed he could understand. His own mother had believed it, enough to keep it from him all that time, and she'd known Valerie better than any of them.
I'm so sorry, Charlie. I was in an impossible situation. I couldn't stay. I couldn't take Amy. I knew how much you loved us. The only thing I could think of was to protect you from it and give you at least something that you could build a future with. If I'd told you the truth, or what I thought was the truth, then all our lives would have been ruined. I know I hurt you, but it was the lesser of two evils.
Charlie almost laughed. The irony was pitiful.
Don't go.
Charlie was at the door. You need to sleep. To rest.
But I'm not going to, and we both know it. What am I supposed to tell them tomorrow? How can I possibly explain how things were?
He shut the door and walked back to the bed and lay next to her on top of the covers, his arms behind his head.
Answer their questions, tell them what you know. I don't know what I know, since everything I knew is gone. Undone by one lie after another, I thought Valerie was my mother, I thought Frances was my sister. Then that changed, and now I don't know anything. Is Frances my mother? It might not have been you who got her pregnant, but did someone else? If she did have me, why has she always treated me as if I'm an offensive smell under her nose? Why does she bring me back here if she hates me so much? If she is my mother and knew what I had been told, why risk this situation and the truth coming out? Actually, that last was a fair point. Charlie had already puzzled over Rachel's sudden reappearance. It was as if Frances didn't know why Rachel had left. I've been thinking about that. I figured she needed you back to do something about the house, sell it or whatever. I don't know, but you're right, it doesn't make sense. Do you think she did kill Roy?
No idea. I was in prison at the time, remember? You were there, what do you think?
It came out with more grit than he had intended. Rachel turned her head away and bit her lip.
Sorry, I didn't mean that to come out the way it did. I meant, what do you remember about when Roy went missing?
He had a hair trigger where the past was concerned, and his manner always ran away with his mouth. The answer was, not a lot. One day he was there, the next he was gone. After, she hesitated, well, after Patsy, he kind of lost the plot. I suppose I just figured he'd left. Let's face it, no one was sorry to see him go. He wasn't missed, I never questioned it. You know what it was like in that house, no one asked questions, we just made the best of it. She turned her head towards him. He'd fallen asleep while she'd been talking. Charlie? That was all it had ever taken for him. His head on a pillow for a few minutes. Was that how sleep happened for people with a clear conscience?
Chapter 29. Diana didn't like Delia Jones. Fact. It had taken just a few seconds for her to form her first impression of the woman, and it hadn't gone well. First, Diana didn't hold with Kitch. Delia's house was full of it, and she had the distinct impression that it was a front. There was so much junk in the house that every item jostled with the next, clamouring for attention. On first sight, Diana had noticed a hard streak in Delia Jones, which clashed with the way she presented herself, as if the little trinkets and ornaments that cluttered every surface were a distraction from the woman's real nature. Diana was an excellent judge of character. She had to be. She dealt with difficult people on a daily basis and had honed her ability to sum people up into a fine art. Delia Jones did not pass muster. Second, Diana noticed that Delia was instantly wary of her, and didn't appear to like the fact that Rachel had an ally. She had gushed a little too strenuously about how pleased she was that Rachel had found friends in London. Third, Delia served cheap tea, made from cheap tea bags in chunky china mugs. Anathema to Diana, who would rather drink pond water from a jam jar than tolerate a poor quality tea bag. It was an idiosyncratic thing, and she would normally have let it go. But in this instance, it sealed her opinion of Delia, who was relegated to the category of all fake fur coat and no knickers. Given that Diana was a guest in the woman's house, it did not bode well for the stay. A fact categorically confirmed by Delia's decision to put her in the peach and grey-themed bedroom, which sported a very soft and noisy bed, which had been made up with slightly damp nylon sheets. The combination of the colours in the room and the sensation of the bedding against her skin put Diana's teeth firmly on edge all night. Consequently, she did not sleep well and was uncharacteristically grumpy in the morning. Delia's idea of breakfast was a cup of the abysmal tea and three Benson and Hedges. Amy had helped herself to sliced white toast with margarine and offered some to Diana, who refused, claiming that she wasn't a breakfast person, though she could have murdered a cup of Earl Grey and a bowl of all bran. Not that she considered herself a snob, well, not much of one. It was just that she felt that it was important to appreciate good quality food. It was doubly ridiculous to her that a child died of starvation every 3 seconds somewhere in the world, so that the people of the West could eat sliced white fluff spread with copious quantities of axle grease.
"So, Di, how do you think Rachel will bear up today when the police start questioning her?"
Delia asked, while slowly exhaling a stream of smoke that hung like toxic fog over the table.
"It's Diana. I'm hoping she'll cope well. After all, it's not as if she hadn't had considerable practice at managing stress," she replied with forced politeness, battling the urge to wave her hand like a fan and clear the air.
"So that's why you're here, is it? To support her?"
"Yes, that's right. I think she needs people in a corner, don't you?"
Amy was looking from one to the other, a piece of limp toast poised in her hand. Diana surmised that she might have picked up some of the thinly veiled animosity that was prickling the air between herself and Delia.
In fact, I think I'd like to get round there and see her as soon as possible. Are you coming, Amy?
Delia raised an eyebrow and took another puff on her cigarette. Diana was up, gathering her things, whilst Amy crammed toast in her mouth and tried to catch up.
Thank you so much for letting me stay. It was very kind of you, Diana said, with as much grace as she could manage on an empty stomach.
Any time, Delia said, stubbing out her cigarette and immediately lighting another one, much to Diana's disgust. Amy ran upstairs to collect her bag, leaving Diana waiting impatiently by the door, basic etiquette dictating that she couldn't leave and wait outside. Delia pointed her cigarette at her.
Just a word of warning, Di. I've known Rachel a long time. She has her problems. She doesn't, well, how can I put it, always see things the way they are. I suspect it's to do with her having fits and that. Must do something to your head over time.
Diana narrowed her eyes and frowned.
What exactly are you saying? Just that things aren't always as they seem, that's all, Delia said with a shrug, just as Amy came down the stairs.
Right, I'm ready, Amy said, hauling her bag onto her shoulder and heading for the door.
See you later, Gran. Thanks for letting us stay.
Delia smiled at her granddaughter, but her cold stare was directed straight at Diana. Diana could only conclude that Delia had spotted something in her, some quality that she didn't like. Probably the fact that Diana had made no secret of the fact that she wasn't falling for the sweet old granny act. Delia Jones might be a lot of things, but sweet old granny she wasn't. Since the moment they had met, each had instinctively been testing the other's mettle. One thing Diana was sure about was that Delia Jones was not concerned about Rachel's welfare, and she had more than a vested interest in the outcome of the girl's return. Diana had met many Delias over the years. They were hard women who had lived hard lives. They were a breed apart, and their motivations weren't always immediately clear. From what she'd been able to gather, Delia's history was closely woven with Rachel's and that of her family. Amy had told her a lot on the train journey yesterday, but not enough for Diana to have a completely accurate picture of what had led Rachel and her family to this point. Besides, it had been the Delia version. Amy had stressed that Charlie never talked about the past. According to Amy, her grandmother had been the single stable influence in the dysfunctional Porter family, her loyalty and hard work being the only things that had kept the household functioning at all. Valerie had been a neurotic drunk, Stella a mental case, Frances a prima donna of delusional proportions, and Rachel a poor victim of all their machinations. Amy explained that her grandmother had agreed to work for Valerie as a favour, an act of support for an old childhood friend who was down on her luck. She had stayed because she was worried what might happen if she left. Charlie had just been sucked into the family as a matter of course, and Delia had painted herself as the old family retainer who had been ill-paid for her efforts. Diana didn't buy it. There was much more to Delia Jones's involvement with the Porters than can be explained by a glib memoir recounted to a loyal grandchild. For instance, why on earth had Delia maintained links with the family after Charlie's conviction? Surely no amount of loyalty to an old friend or concern for Rachel could have withstood the betrayal of her own child. Then there was Charlie. Diana had developed good instincts about dangerous men. She had dealt with the fallout of domestic violence for enough years to spot an arsehole a mile off. Charlie was not a dangerous man. Definitely not a killer, though she was reserving judgment on whether or not he was an arsehole. No, there was something very dark at the center of this situation. If only for Rachel's sake, Diana was going to find out what it was. D.S. Ratcliffe and D.C. Watson got out of the car and approached the two uniformed officers who stood outside the haberdashery shop that belonged to the Porter family. A strip of crime scene tape fluttered delicately across the open doorway. The smell of petrol was overwhelming.
So, Ratcliffe said, holding his hand over his mouth. He never had been able to stand the smell of petrol.
Attempted arson attack by the looks of it, sir. Someone poured petrol through the letterbox, but the fire never took hold. It seems there might have been a water leak of some kind recently. Everything that side of the door was too wet to burn, so the fire just fizzled out. Lucky, really, one of the officers volunteered.
Angie pointed up to a CCTV camera that was aimed directly at the doorway.
Anything on that?
The other officer shook her head.
Not even connected, just here for show, I'm afraid.
And no one saw anything, Angie added.
We're still checking, but nothing so far. You might want to take a look upstairs in the flat.
Ratcliffe ducked under the tape and held it up for Angie to follow him. They walked past the fire-scarred door and practically paddled up the hallway to the stairs, their feet squelching on the sodden carpet. The mingled smell of petrol and damp was nauseating, and Ratcliffe anticipated the second coming of his breakfast if it kept up. The report of the attempted arson attack on the shop had been on his desk first thing that morning, along with a note from Ferris that the body at the Limes had been confirmed to be that of Stella Baxter. It stood to reason that if Stella had set fire to the Limes, she might have had a go at the shop too. What didn't stack up was the fact that the house fire had taken place during daylight, the shop later. After all, the shop was on the high street, this side door just off it. It was unlikely that a burning door would have attracted the attention of at least one member of the public. The fire brigade hadn't even been called. The flames were all out by the time the milk delivery driver had noticed the damage and had told the manager of the next-door mini-mart whilst handing him a tray of semi-skimmed. The owner of the mini-mart was a conscientious man and had reported it to the police immediately. As soon as the operator in the call centre had typed in the details of the incident into her computer, the machine had done its magic and cross-referenced the address with their case. He'd been meaning to investigate the place anyway. It just pissed him off that incidents kept happening before he'd had a chance to look into things. It made him seem incompetent. He was beginning to think that someone involved with the Porter mess had it in for him. Wondering what other little surprises were in store for him that day, he led the way upstairs to the flat above the shop, where a couple of sockos were already busy about their work, looking like diligent, white-clad gnomes. At first glance, the sitting room looked like a typical crack house. Filthy, squalid, neglected, vile. But there was no drug paraphernalia. "What's the deal?" Ratcliffe asked one of the sockos.
"Not much. Looks like somebody's been in residence fairly recently. We have found traces of food that aren't too old. Also some women's clothes."
"Stella?" Angie asked. Ratcliffe nodded.
"That would be my guess."
He stepped carefully across the room and glanced into a rancid kitchen full of mouse droppings and the fetid remains of meals recently eaten, all mixed and mingled with the wrappings the food had come in. It made him want to gag. Angie had gone towards the bedroom. He heard her gasp. "Come and have a look at this," she called. Ratcliffe joined her, and neither of them spoke as they looked around the room. It had been decorated as a nursery. Lambs and ducklings gambolled across the walls on a pastel-coloured background. A crib, draped with lace and frills, sat in the middle of the room next to a nursing chair. A cobwebbed mobile dangled forlornly from the ceiling. Everything was damp and mouldering, so that the little yellow ducks had a green tinge to their feathers, and the lambs already had a smattering of mint sauce. It would have been just sad. A depressing little scene, one to tug at the heartstrings, if it hadn't been for the dolls. There were hundreds of dolls. Naked, mutilated dolls. They sat around the walls, all their little china and plastic hands pointing into the room towards the nursing chair. Their little fingers extended, accusing, pleading, beckoning. It was difficult to tell. Angie shuddered.
"Look at their eyes."
Ratcliffe was looking. The room was dim, but he could see well enough to tell that every eye in every little head had been poked out. A countless battalion of sightless, sinister little effigies surrounded them. Revulsion rippled across his senses. "Jesus!" It was the only word he could think of, and he wasn't sure if it was a reaction or a plea. Angie shivered again. "Do you think Stella did this because of the dead baby?" she asked. "God knows."
"Maybe it's ghoulish, though." That was one word for it, Ratcliffe thought. He could think of others. Macabre, grisly, gruesome, morbid, ghastly. The list went on. "Shall we get out of here now?" he said. It was going to be hard enough to shake off this little tableau without having it permanently engraved on his mind. "Hold on, there's something else." Angie pulled a small maglite out of her pocket and aimed the beam at the chest of one of the dolls. Its empty eye sockets looked even more menacing, half lit by the thin beam of light. It was like Play School meets the Blair Witch, Ratcliffe thought with grim humour. It didn't help lighten the situation. "What have you found?"
"Something's been written on the chests." She swung the beam around, randomly illuminating the tiny bare torsos. Ratcliffe squinted.
"What does it say?"
"I'm not sure. I think it says Peccavisti. What the hell does that mean?"
"It means you have sinned. It's Latin and a bit melodramatic, don't you think?"
The sudden insertion of Julia Ferris's dulcet tones into the creepy atmosphere of the room made them both jump.
"Sorry, chaps, didn't mean to startle you," she said with a smile.
Oh, this is a macabre little set-up, isn't it? She had gloves on and was suited and booted for the occasion. She picked up one of the dolls and turned it over carefully. As she tilted it, a plaintive little voice wailed from its rosebud mouth. Mama. Nice touch, Julia said, placing it back on the floor in its original position. I take it you got my message. We have a positive ID on our crispy critter. It is Stella Baxter. Ratcliffe nodded. Yeah, I think she must have tried to burn this place, too. Looking around, he wished she hadn't. The scene would be far more palatable as a pile of charred wood and molten plastic. I doubt it. Ratcliffe turned to face Julia. Eh? Stella was dead before the fire started. No smoke in her lungs. If the chair in the middle of the room had not been part of a potential crime scene, Ratcliffe would have plopped down into it and held his head in his hands in a fit of despair. Would this never end? How did she die? It looks like she was strangled. Her hyoid bone was broken. It's a typical indication of strangulation, Julia said casually. Great, Ratcliffe said, gritting his teeth. Now he had to look for another murderer who was also a pyromaniac. Given Frances's propensity for burning potential evidence, he would have pointed the finger at her, but she had been in a cell at the time of the fire. Rachel and Charlie had been in London. Peter Haynes, Angie suggested, as if she could see his train of thought. Doubt he would have the gumption, but he was pissed off when we arrested his wife. I suppose we have to go and ask some questions, though. D.I. Benton was so not going to like this. Chapter 30 I'm surprised your gran didn't want to come with us today, Diana said as she and Amy made their way up Charlie's drive. Oh, yeah, she said she had a visit planned. Some old friend in hospital she had to go and see. She'll be round later. Gran wouldn't miss out on a drama if she can help it. Amy laughed, fishing in her pocket for her house key. Hello, it's me. Anybody up yet? Amy called from the hallway. The house was still in darkness, the curtains drawn. Probably having a lie-in. He hasn't had a decent kip in days, she said, by way of explanation to Diana. He's getting too old for all this excitement. She pulled back the curtains and let the daylight flood in. Now that the gloom was lifted, Diana was glad to see that Charlie had not inherited his mother's proclivity for surrounding herself with tacky clutter. His home was clean and modern, not a frill or a flounce in sight. She could breathe easy. Somewhere up above, she heard the creak of floorboards. Amy's voice had woken both Rachel and Charlie with a start. Charlie was shocked to see that the bedside clock said 9:30. They were both shocked to find out that she had been holding his left hand, while his right arm had been draped across her chest. He pulled away from her as if her stunned gaze were an electric current. Sorry, he said hastily, jumping up from the bed and scurrying to the door. Hi, love, put the kettle on, will you? I'll go and wake Rachel, he lied, making a big show of knocking on the door he was holding. Once he was sure the coast was clear, he stumbled to the bathroom and splashed cold water onto his stubbled face. The towel smelled vaguely of Rachel. Rachel lay in the bed, her right side chilled by the absence of Charlie's body heat. Conversely, her leg was throbbing and hot. In fact, her whole left side felt as if it were on fire. She didn't feel good. Charlie had left her tablets on the bedside table, so she took two of everything just to be sure. Then she painfully inched her leg out of the bed. She was defeated by the mere thought of trying to get dressed, so instead helped herself to Charlie's dressing gown, which was hanging on the back of the door. Getting downstairs was a slow and painful process, and mostly involved putting her body weight on the banister and swinging the duff leg onto the stair below before gritting her teeth and making it bear her weight for a second or two. By the time she reached the bottom, she was flushed in the face and exhausted. The night's sleep may as well not have happened for all the good it had done. The look on Diana's face as she entered the lounge, red-faced and wearing Charlie's clothes, told her that Diana thought her state was down to entirely different reasons than fever and tiredness, but she felt too lousy to bother explaining herself. She eased herself onto the sofa and took the coffee that Diana held out for her with grateful relief. Charlie and Amy were in the kitchen. Rachel could hear his mobile phone ringing above the noise of the cupboards being open and shut, and to her surprise, he came in and offered her the phone.
For you. D.S. Ratcliffe.
Hesitating for a moment, she took the phone. She had been dreading this. Hello? Everyone's eyes were on her as she listened to the detective. Finally, she handed the phone back to Charlie. I'm not sure how you turn it off, she said in a voice that sounded too weak and too thin to be her own.
Is everything all right? Diana asked, leaning forward. They've had confirmation that it was Stella who was in the house. Apparently it's more complicated than that. Other things have come up. He wouldn't tell me on the phone, but he's coming here later. Apparently I'm not to go anywhere.
Just as well, looking at the state of you. In fact, I don't think you should leave that sofa today, Charlie said, pressing his hand to her forehead and looking concerned.
I'm fine, don't fuss,
she said, batting him away. We'll see. Look, Amy and I are going shopping. There's barely any food in the house, and we need milk desperately. We won't be long.
Amy had hung back, quiet after yesterday's outburst, almost shy, in fact. Rachel gave her a tentative smile and was pleased to have it returned. I have to go with him, or we could be living on pot noodles for a week, Amy said. Rachel wanted to laugh, but it hurt. After they had gone, Diana turned to her.
So what did the detective really say?
Rachel was surprised. Diana had never questioned her before. Like I said, he wants to talk to me sometime today. He wouldn't say much over the phone.
But what do you think?
Look, Rachel, your sister was killed in a fire. Your other sister has been arrested for murder. Your mother died a few weeks ago. Your long-lost husband and daughter have just popped out of the woodwork, and people aren't who you thought they were. Need I go on?
When you put it all together like that, it's a pretty abysmal catalogue of disasters, Rachel said with a wry smile.
Diana nodded vigorously, the expression on her face exaggerated by her raised eyebrows.
Yes, it is. It's a bloody mess. And you're sitting there showing less reaction than someone who has just been told that the post would be late today.
Rachel sighed. She didn't feel well. Diana was right, she should be reacting differently, but she was looking at it all as if she were at one end of a long tunnel, and the cataclysmic mess that threatened to engulf her was at the other. She explained this to Diana and added,
So, do you suggest that I rush to meet it head on?
Diana looked guilty for pushing the matter.
No, of course not. I suppose I'm just a bit shell-shocked by it all.
I forget you've been living with a lot of these issues for a long time, though I don't know how you've managed it. I think you've been remarkably strong.
Denial is a wonderful thing, Rachel thought to herself. Anyway, let's change the subject. How did you get on at Delia's last night?
Diana grimaced.
Let's put it this way. I don't think we're likely to become lifelong friends any time soon.
Rachel smiled.
Was she a bit rough and ready for you?
She can be rather blunt, but she means well. Without Delia, I think we might have all fallen apart a lot sooner.
God knows what her reasons were, but she kept the family ticking for a long time.
We have a lot to be grateful to her for. Why was she so loyal to your family?
Rachel shrugged.
I don't really know, other than she had links with my mother that went back to childhood. There was some bond there.
She was more loyal than she needed to be, I know that much. Mother treated her like a skivvy.
Yet she carried on her involvement with Joal even after what happened to Charlie.
Yeah, but don't ask me to explain it.
It's impossible enough to make sense of my family as it is.
Now her hand was beginning to throb too. Do you mind if we don't do any more questions? I think I might be getting enough of that when the police turn up.
It was uncharacteristically rude of her, but that tunnel was getting shorter with every word.
Of course.
You should rest. You look a bit peaky, to be honest, Diana said, worried that she had added to her friend's stress. She had come here to support her, not increase her burden. However, Rachel's state of calm in the face of so much trauma was quite worrying. The dam had to give way sometime, and she felt she needed to be there when it did. As for Delia Jones, it was clear that no one else had the same reservations about the woman. Still, they all knew Delia a damn sight better than she did, and perhaps she would be wise to reserve judgment. In the meantime, she needed more tea, and Rachel needed rest. Quietly, she left the room to take advantage of Charlie's decent tea bags and the peace and quiet of his uncluttered kitchen. Ratcliffe could feel the beginnings of a headache. His left eye felt twitchy and white light zigzagged around the periphery of his vision. Peter Haynes had a cast-iron alibi for the fire. He had been home at the time, but not alone. His sister and her husband had been with him and could account for his every move since he had left the police station after Francis's arrest. If Ratcliffe had judged Peter as imperious, his sister turned out to be the High Priestess of Pomposity. She and her husband made Francis and Peter look positively accommodating in comparison. Ratcliffe was just glad he didn't have to interview the Haynes parents. He didn't think his will could have stood it. Those two had definitely learned their high-handedness from someone. One thing that had been abundantly clear from their meeting was that Peter Haynes had no intention of standing by his wife. Bail for Francis was out of the question, and Haynes had been relieved about it, using the reprieve from his wife as an opportunity to get the hell out of Dodge. The only satisfaction Ratcliffe had from the meeting was in finding out that the Limes had not been insured. Fate had made doubly sure that Peter Haynes wouldn't see a penny from the place. "Rough justice," Ratcliffe had commented to Angie as they left. She didn't seem to get it. She was still wittering on about the Dolls of Satan scene back at the flat. They had no clear suspect for Stella's murder. His only chance was to see if Rachel could shed any light on who may have wanted to bump Stella off and burn down the family home. Given that she claimed she hadn't spoken to any of them for 20 years, it was a long shot, yet it was the only chance he had. He might have put Charlie Jones in the frame if he hadn't been with Rachel the day of the fire. Charlie had motive. Stella's testimony had put him away, and he might have had a claim on the house if his marriage to Rachel had panned out. If Stella had ever told him the story she had recounted at the police station, he might have had even more reason to bump her off in a fit of fury. However, Charlie wasn't there and hadn't done it, so all this mindless conjecture was useless. Though it was better than thinking about D.I. Benton having his head on the block. By the time they reached Charlie's house and pulled up on the drive, his head was pounding. "Got any paracetamol?" he asked. Women always had stuff like that. Angie rummaged in her bag and passed him a pink box. "Will these do?" "Feminax, what the hell are they?" he said, peering at the box and reading that they were for the relief of menstrual cramps. What the hell, pain was pain. He ripped open the box and took two, swallowing them down with tepid coffee from a polystyrene cup. He had visions of them doing more than dealing with his headache. If he found himself worrying whether his arse looked too big in his suit or discussing the price of leg waxing any time soon, he would swing for Angie Watson. "Ta," he said, handing the box back and ignoring her grin. A woman Ratcliffe didn't recognize opened the door. He held up his warrant card. "D.C. Ratcliffe and D.C. Watson to see Rachel Porter." "She's expecting you. Come on through," the woman said with a warmer smile than either of them were used to receiving when they knocked on a door. "And you are?" Angie asked. "Diana Lovell, friend of Rachel's." She extended her hand, obligating Angie to shake it. Rachel was supine on the sofa, wearing a man's dressing gown. She looked like shit. The past few days had taken their toll on her. Her hair was dull, her face puffy, her breathing rapid. Her skin looked clammy, as if she was running a fever. Ratcliffe had quite fancied her when they first met. Now she looked a wreck. "Hello again, Miss Porter, or can I call you Rachel?" She nodded. "Have a seat. I'm sure someone will make you both a cup of tea." Ratcliffe looked hopefully at the others in the room. Charlie Jones, Diana Lovell and the daughter. Amy, looking more like her mother than her mother did at that moment. Charlie Jones didn't look like he was preparing to go anywhere. He was leaning against the mantelpiece with his arms crossed, but the woman, the so-called friend, had cottoned on and ushered the girl out of the room with her. Ratcliffe sat in the chair closest to Rachel, Angie on a dining chair which she pulled to the end of the sofa so that she was looking directly at Rachel. They both watched as she pulled herself into a sitting position. "I'm afraid we have some more bad news for you, Rachel," Ratcliffe said, the vice that was gripping his head loosening a bit. That girly stuff was quite good, he noted. "I have been told by our pathologist today that Stella didn't die as a result of the fire. It would appear that she was dead before the fire started." He was fully expecting Rachel to send into a seizure at that point, and had been bracing himself for it. But she didn't. Instead, the red flush in her cheeks began to recede, leaving an ashen grey in its wake. Within moments, she looked like a statue that had been carved from dirty wax. "Are you all right?" he asked. She didn't speak for a moment, just closed her eyes. Charlie stepped forward, but she waved him away. "It's all right. I'm not going to have a fit. It seems that new medication won't let me. If she didn't die in the fire, how did she die?" Ratcliffe explained that they suspected that she had been strangled. "By who? Who would do that?" Rachel asked, clutching her own throat as if she could remember what it felt like to have someone's hands around it. Ratcliffe glanced at Charlie, who looked suitably shocked. "That's what we don't know. Is there anyone you know of who might have held a grudge against Stella, or who she might have had cause to be afraid of?" To his surprise, Rachel laughed, albeit weakly. "Sorry, it's just that Stella was frightened of everyone. But the only three people who might have borne her any ill will are all accounted for. You have Francis, Roy is dead, and so is my mother. Other than that, she didn't know anyone. Well, to the best of my knowledge anyway, but that's years out of date, as I told you before." "Why would she have been afraid of those particular people? They were her family," Angie interjected. "Where do you want me to start?" My mother despised her, thought her weak and pointless, just used her as an unpaid maid. Francis followed suit, ashamed to be related to her, and as for Roy, he resented her. Felt he had married her under false pretenses. Well, once he found out, we didn't have any money anyway. I remember he was quite abusive to her. It was pretty unpleasant. She said all this with her eyes closed, as if she were keeping the memories at bay. Given what Ratcliffe already knew about her family life, he didn't blame her. What about your relationship with her? How was that? Her face creased, and she put her hand up to her mouth as if to stifle a cry. It was the first crack he'd seen in her too calm demeanor.
Sorry, she said, her voice cracking. I'm having difficulty taking all this in.
Charlie stepped forward again, as if he intended to comfort her, but he appeared to think better of it, and went back to brooding near the fireplace.
Sorry, Rachel said again. In answer to your question, our relationship was as good as was possible, under the circumstances. Stella was the one who looked after me, took me to school, fed me, read to me, put me to bed. She was kind. It was a rare thing in our house, an odd thing. I don't think I was as kind to her as she was to me.
Ratcliffe and Angie exchanged glances.
In what way weren't you kind? He asked.
I didn't really know how to respond to her affection. It was a bit alien, more frightening in some ways than the others were. I don't know, it's difficult to explain. And of course I left her there when I went to London. I shouldn't have done that.
Why did you leave her behind? Angie asked.
Ratcliffe felt it was more out of simple curiosity than the chance that her answer might take them forward. Rachel pointed at Charlie. I still blamed her for testifying against Charlie. She knew as well as I did that he didn't kill Patsy.
It was a difficult moment. Awkward.
Ratcliffe didn't want things to digress into a discussion on whether Charlie Jones had been wrongfully convicted of his first wife's murder.
That's understandable, under the circumstances.
So you can't think of anyone who might have a motive to harm her?
Rachel shook her head.
Have you ever been inside the flat above the shop?
She looked puzzled. The flat? Not for years. Not since I was little. Why?
Well, someone attempted to burn that down as well. We were called there this morning, Ratcliffe said, watching puzzlement transmute into complete confusion on her face.
Can you describe the flat to us as you remember it? Angie asked. God, it's a long time ago. It's a typical flat. Really? I think it was used mostly for storage. But there had been a squatter, some old tramp. So it was locked up and left. I think there was a bit of furniture in the sitting room. Stella used to have her lunch break up there sometimes. But it was pretty grim, as I recall. She stopped going up there after the tramp, I think. Sorry, it's all a bit vague.
Did you ever go into the bedroom there? Ratcliffe wanted to know.
I don't think so. Why?
We think someone might have been using the place quite recently. Do you know who had keys to the shop and the flat?
There was just one set that Stella used. She worked in the shop. I did too, for a little while.
And you didn't go into the flat while you worked at the shop?
No, like I said, no one did after the tramp. It was always locked up.
Would you say that Stella had strange preoccupations at all? Anything you might have found odd in her behaviour? Ratcliffe asked.
I think we were all a bit odd. It's a family trait. She was very quiet. Timid, I suppose. It's hard to say. None of us is exactly normal, are we?
Both Angie and Ratcliffe had to concede this was true. At that point, Diana came in with a tray of tea and handed out the mugs.
Would you like me to go back into the kitchen? She asked.
Stay if you like, Rachel said. You can hear all about just how fucked up we all are.
It came out with a tinge of vitriol that surprised everyone.
Sorry, Di, that wasn't aimed at you. It's just that having to talk about all this makes me realize just how weird we really are. I mean,
were.
As she tailed off, she stretched out her leg and winced with pain. Charlie spoke for the first time.
Have you taken your tablets?
This morning, I probably need to take more.
He nodded and left the room. They all waited while he climbed the stairs and fetched her medication. They drank their tea as she swallowed a fistful of pills. She was looking really quite ill now, and it was seriously unsettling Charlie Jones.
What about your relationship with Francis?
Rachel laughed again, but this time it made her breathless.
Can being treated as an annoying inconvenience count as a relationship?
Francis tolerated me because she had no choice.
Yet you came back when she asked you to, Ratcliffe said, remembering the letter Rachel had told them about the first time they'd met. She didn't ask, she'd commanded, Rachel said dryly. They both saw Charlie nod in agreement. Maybe it was time he contributed to this conversation a little more, Ratcliffe thought. What was her relationship with Roy Baxter like? He asked, encompassing Charlie in the question. As I remember, they sort of got on. They argued a lot, but more like banter. I think she liked him. No, not liked, admired him. She thought he had guts. This was interesting. Would you agree, Mr. Jones? Ratcliffe asked, aiming his gaze at Charlie. Charlie shrugged. I suppose. She used to flirt with him a lot. Mainly because it used to bug Stella, I think, but I suppose you could say they got on. Any idea why she might have killed him, given that it appears their relationship might have been relatively good? How do you know she did? You've been wrong before, was Charlie's barbed reply. We have sufficient evidence to prove it. Which reminds me, do either of you recognize this? Ratcliffe pulled out a photograph from his pocket and showed it to them. It's an earring. Rachel took the photo and peered at the earring. Frances had a pair like that. They were a birthday present from our mother. I remember them because I borrowed them once. She went mad at me. Where did you find it? Ratcliffe took the picture back. In Roy Baxter's hand, along with a handful of her hair. Pretty conclusive, I'm afraid. Has she confessed? Charlie asked. No, and it won't go in her favour. Then perhaps she didn't do it, Charlie said. Ratcliffe gave him a dismissive look and turned his attention back to Rachel. Do you remember anything about the day Roy disappeared? Anything at all? I've been trying to think back since he was found, and I honestly keep drawing a blank. All I can say was that one day he was there, the next he was gone. I can't even give you a date. I remember knowing he had left Stella, but no one talked about it. Everyone was relieved. Life was calmer afterwards. We were glad. He was found in the shed, near the house. What do you remember about that shed? Angie asked. Nothing, it was just a shed. Always locked. Again, I never questioned it. Ratcliffe looked at Angie. It didn't seem like they were going to get much more than this from Rachel. I think that's about it for today, but we might have more questions. Will you be here for a while? I don't know, Rachel said weakly. He could see sweat trickling down the front of her neck. It was starting to pool in the hollows of her collarbone. Yes, she will, Charlie said. One more thing, Rachel said as they stood to leave. The baby, you haven't said anything about the baby. Ratcliffe sighed. Still a bit of a mystery, I'm afraid. We do know that he was stillborn, so no one is suspected of murdering him. Someone could be charged with concealing the body, but we suspect that either your mother or Stella was responsible for that, and obviously we have no way of proving it, and no one to pursue for a crime. The body will be released for burial at some point. Would you like us to let you know? She nodded. She had found him. She would deal with it. Back in the car, when they had pulled off the drive and were a little way down the road, Angie asked, Why didn't you tell her about Stella? About her claims of being her mother? Don't you think she has a right to know? Ratcliffe had put a lot of thought into this one. Yeah, I do, but not yet. You saw the state of her. I don't think she's up to hearing that she's the product of incest right at this moment, do you? Besides, Ferris said there's no clear evidence of it. Stella could, but might not be, her birth mother. But Rachel's got to know, sometime, if it's true. My plan is to let her get her head around this little lot, then call her into the station. I think we'll let Dr. Ferris explain that one. It's her bag, not ours. Angie shot him a wry smile. She'll love you for that. Ratcliffe just shrugged. Got any more of those Femi things? They're pretty good. After they had gone, Diana busied herself by tidying up the tea things. She was good at knowing when to leave while alone. Charlie looked pensive and uncomfortable, not surprising given his history with the police. Amy had explained it to her while they had made the tea, protesting his innocence more than was necessary. Now he was rooting about in the freezer, muttering about making a meal for them all. Diana offered to do the cooking, and he took her up on the offer with visible relief. He was about to go back into the lounge when Diana caught his arm and shook her head, pointing surreptitiously into the other room. Through the half-open door, they could see Amy sitting with Rachel in what appeared to be a comfortable silence. A good sign in Diana's book. Leave them to it. You could peel some potatoes if you like, she said. Charlie nodded and started to run water into the sink.
Diane smiled and passed him the peeler. Amy sat next to Rachel.
I don't know what to call you, she said.
Rachel looked up at her child, who was not a child, but a younger, better version of herself.
What do you mean?
She knew exactly what Amy meant, but didn't have a solution. She figured she was lucky that the girl was talking to her at all. Well, I can't call you Rachel, it wouldn't be right, and calling you Mum is strange. I don't mean to be horrible, but it feels weird.
You're not being horrible, I understand. I don't know what to suggest, but I won't object to Rachel if it feels more comfortable.
Okay. Can I get you anything? You look really tired. Do you want a blanket? Rachel shook her head, though the movement made her dizzy and nauseous.
No, thanks. I'm actually feeling really hot. My leg's a bit sore. I probably need to change the dressing again. I think your dad's got some stuff. Would you ask him?
Sure. Can I do it for you? I need the practice, wound care and all. Rachel had forgotten that Amy was training to be a nurse.
Yeah, if you like.
Amy raced off into the kitchen, was back in minutes with Charlie's first aid kit, a clean towel and a bowl of water. She put the towel under Rachel's leg and started to unwrap the bandage that Charlie had put on.
Strictly speaking, I should be using a sterile dressing pack, but we'll have to make do with what we have, she said, carefully peeling the old dressing away from Rachel's leg.
Heat was radiating from the wound, which was angry and red, the stitches tight. Pus oozed from it, and there was a sweet, nauseating smell. A red line extended along her leg. The inflammation was spreaded. She knew enough to realize that this was a bad sign.
Just going to check your pulse rate and breathing.
Might as well go the whole hog as I'm here, Amy said, gently grasping Rachel's wrist and measuring her pulse against the ticking of the clock. Rachel already knew it was far too fast, as was her breathing, which was shallow and rapid. She was hot. Too hot.
How do you feel? Amy asked.
The girl wasn't daft. Rachel could see that she was worried.
Pretty lousy, if I'm honest,
Rachel said with a thin smile.
Okay, I'm just going to go and get something from the kitchen. I won't be long.
Amy shut the door behind her quietly. Her dad was at the sink. Diana was peeling carrots next to him.
Dad, it's Rachel. She's running a temperature. She's tachycardic. The wound is infected and her respirations aren't right. These aren't good signs.
Charlie put the potato he had been peeling into the sink and dried his hands.
Say that again in English.
I think she might be in sepsis. I mean, she might have blood poisoning, Amy said, her heart pounding almost as fast as Rachel's.
Let me look at her, he said, striding towards the door as if Amy was overreacting. Diana dropped the carrot and followed, wiping her hands on her skirt. As Charlie opened the door, they all heard a dull but significant thud. Rachel lay on the floor in the throes of a massive convulsion. Diana rushed past him, throwing herself down beside Rachel.
This isn't like a normal fit. You better call an ambulance, she called.
Charlie's fingers were shaking as he dialed 999, whilst Amy quietly sobbed at his elbow.
Is she going to be all right, Dad?
She whispered once the ambulance was on its way.
I don't know, love. I don't know.
He had a horrible sense of dread that Rachel might have pushed it too far this time, and the thought clutched at his heart like an ice-cold fist. Chapter 31 Ratcliffe's breast pocket started to vibrate yet again.
Bloody hell, what now? He demanded of no one in particular as he retrieved the buzzing phone.
What's up? Angie asked as they paused their walk across the car park outside the station. Ratcliffe put the phone back in his pocket.
Rachel Porter is in hospital, in the ICU in critical condition, apparently. Blood poisoning from her leg injury, he said dully.
Angie took a breath.
Bloody silly cow. What is it with these people?
She had just about had a gutful of the Porter family. They were a bloody nightmare. She couldn't stand self-effacing people like Rachel Porter. Did they honestly think they were being brave and stoic in the face of adversity? Bullshit. They were the most selfish types of all. Half of them killed themselves with self-neglect and left everyone else to pick up the pieces. The other half sucked the rest of the population dry. Shame the whole family hadn't been in that bloody house when it went up in flames.
I need a drink, Ratcliffe said. You coming?
Does a bear shit in the woods? She said through gritted teeth.
When they reached the pub, Ratcliffe sat moodily staring into his pint, and she had to wonder why he'd bothered to ask her to go with him. He wasn't with it. His mind was elsewhere, still on the case, she suspected.
Come on. Share, she said, waving her hand in front of his face to break his trance.
He sat back and let out a long, slow breath.
Just thinking that we've missed something. We should at least have a suspect and we don't have a clue. That room in the flat. Do you think Stella did it? Like some kind of weird guilt trip thing over the incest in having a child?
I suppose it fits. I mean, you saw her. She was hardly sane.
Or any of them? Was Angie's cynical response.
What's bugging me is that if she didn't set fire to the flat, who did and why? My guess is that someone else knows the room exists, and that person didn't want it found. But that person is also getting sloppy. The fire didn't take. The room has been seen.
It stands to reason that it's the same person who killed Stella then, doesn't it? She said. It did stand to reason, but she wasn't entirely sure how or what their motive might be.
So what did Stella know that this person didn't want her to talk about? What's in that room that might give the game away? And who haven't we talked to that we should have?
Always the same. More questions than answers. Well, we've got Frances Haynes for Roy Baxter. She isn't talking and it's not helping her, so it can't be to do with what happened to him, so it must be to do with what happened to the baby, given what was in that room.
But why isn't Frances Haynes talking? Ratcliffe asked, finally taking a large slug of beer.
Thank God. Angie was down to the watery dregs of a melting ice cube in her glass.
Another, she said, now that he had less than half a pint. She stood to go to the bar.
Obviously she's not talking because she doesn't want to land herself in the shit even deeper, she added.
It didn't take long to be served. The bar was quiet and the barmaid wasn't the chatty type. Mind you, they never were when it came to other women in Angie's experience. When she got back, Ratcliffe looked pensive again.
Maybe you're right, maybe not.
What if she's not talking because she doesn't want to land someone else in the shit?
What do you mean? Baxter had half her DNA in his hand and her earring, which has now been positively ID'd.
She was glad she'd bought double. She had a feeling she might need it. Well, I've been thinking about that, and I think we've been in too much of a hurry to nail someone for this and get it over and done with. Yes, Baxter had her hair in his hand and the earring, but he was bashed over the head with something from behind. Did he reach behind him and grab her while she hit him, or could it be that he attacked her and got hit from behind by someone else?
Are you suggesting she might be innocent?
He shook his head. He had a mouthful of beer. Far from it, I think she's in it up to her neck. For instance, I'm pretty certain she knew exactly where that body was and intended to find it that day with a witness. If she hadn't found him, someone else would have, and she would have instantly been in the frame. She knew Stella was barking, and I'll bet she figured that Stella would take the rap and she would be off the hook.
But wouldn't she have got rid of the forensic evidence first?
Angie reasoned. That guy has been in there for 20-odd years. Back then, the only police show on telly was bloody Z-cars. The public barely understood fingerprinting, let alone DNA analysis. I doubt it even occurred to her that there would be any forensic evidence, and even if it did, I doubt she thought it would have survived.
It wasn't an unreasonable thought, Angie concurred. So we're back to Stella, or the mother as suspects then?
Which is pointless, because they're both dead and we can't prove it. No, we're not. You just said it, they're both dead. And Frances may be covering for someone who is very much alive. If the killer was dead, she could tell us any cock and bull story and we'd have to buy it. And the worst she might be facing is a charge for aiding and abetting or concealing the crime.
But you're suggesting she is worried enough to face a life sentence rather than tell us what actually happened.
He drained his glass. Or I'm talking shit and she did do it. Either way, there's a story there and we need to hear it. Otherwise, this one is going to bug me for the rest of my days.
But who's left in the frame? Rachel?
She was only a kid at the time. It's not impossible, but I don't think she did it. Though I do think she might know more than she thinks she does.
What, like a buried memory or something?
She didn't really believe in such things, but it was a thought.
Maybe. But we're not going to get that out of her anytime soon. There has to be someone else in the picture, someone else connected to the family that we don't know about yet, Ratcliffe said.
So who can we talk to who might know?
There's only one option. Delia Jones.
Charlie came back into the waiting room. Amy had finally stopped crying and appeared to be dozing on a grubby sofa that dominated one wall of the tiny room. Diana was sitting with Rachel and had stayed with her while he'd gone outside to phone his mother and tell her what had happened. He'd had to explain to her that it didn't look good, that the doctors wouldn't speculate on an outcome, and that a nurse had warned him that 2/3 of the people who were hospitalized for septic shock died. He had told his mother that he was prepared for the worst. Delia hadn't said much, and he had taken her silence as an indication of her shock at this turn of events. She had offered to come to the hospital, but he had told her not to bother. Rachel was out of it, hooked up to a ton of machines that were monitoring her life source in a detached and frightening way.
There was nothing anyone could do except wait and see if her body had enough strength left in it to fight the battle. He had his doubts. Even if her body did, he wasn't sure her mind would want to wage war on this never-ending tide of misfortune. He was awash with coffee. It felt like he had done nothing but imbibe gallons of the stuff in the last few hours. Sit with Rachel, get frustrated, go out, drink coffee, calm down, go back and sit with Rachel. It was a caffeine-fueled nightmare on constant loop, and it was all his fault. He should have taken her straight back to hospital as soon as he found out she discharged herself. He'd said that to the doctor, but had been told that it might not have been the best thing at all. The leg infection had been caused by MRSA, and the chances were she'd picked that up at the first hospital. There had been some mention of amputating her leg. If they could stabilize her, that was. It didn't bear thinking about. Elton John's greatest hits were playing in the background. It had been playing over and over since they'd arrived. If he heard Candle in the Wind one more time, he thought he might go insane. Chapter 32. Frances sat demurely on her thin, plastic-covered mattress, stoically ignoring the paper plate full of congealing food. Never, ever had she eaten off a paper plate or used plastic cutlery, and she did not intend to start now. Over the hours, she had wondered if this was the same cell that had held Stella. Not that it mattered either way. They had all been in the same cell for years, just a different kind, where the bars and the steel door were all in the mind. Peter had proven himself the abject disappointment she had always known him to be. At least that hadn't been a surprise in this whole debacle. She put her fingers to the back of her head and felt gently for the lump and the slight bald spot where the hair would never grow back. If only she hadn't fallen like that and knocked herself senseless for days. Otherwise she might have got away with it. Now it was too late. They had evidence of her involvement with the incident. God knows how. She had no memory of him grabbing at her that day or of losing her earring. She never wore those earrings anyway, they were hideous. But to explain that to the police would be far too dangerous, would mean pointing the finger in an entirely different direction with not a shred of evidence. All that planning, all for nothing. Now what? Languish in jail for the rest of her days? There had to be a way out of this, a loophole somewhere. She just needed to think. The charred skeleton of the lines looked sad rather than eerie, illuminated as it was by the sliver of moon that glowed weakly above the trees. Angie hardly knew what she hoped to find there, other than some vague wish that the smoke-blackened bricks might have some sentience and would whisper some dark secret that would be key to the whole case. Instead, she just stood on the drive and felt a bit stupid. There was nothing left. Everything the house ever was had been incinerated, if not by Frances and her initial pyromaniacal rampage, then by this second elimination. But why? She agreed with Ratcliffe. There had always been another person in the loop, someone they had completely overlooked. The discovery of an unmissed, unmourned body so many years after death wasn't much of a deal. Just find the culprit, throw the book at them, job done. It was simpler, in fact, to pin it on Frances rather than Stella. If she had still been alive, Stella would have been declared unfit to stand trial, and would have ended up in a secure psychiatric unit at best. No satisfaction for anyone there. Frances would stand trial, be found guilty, go to prison, and they could all move on. She and Ratcliffe could close the case nice and neatly. Everyone happy. A good result. But for some reason this other element, this third wheel, had ballsed up, re-entering the picture in such a way that their presence could not go unnoticed. But why? There had to be a reason why this person had decided to wipe Stella Baxter and her family home off the face of the planet. There had to be a reason why the same person had tried to do the same thing with the flat. The only explanation in Angie's mind was that all three, Stella, the Limes, the flat, could reveal the identity of the third man. Or woman. Yes, definitely a woman. Angie's instincts told her that the whole miserable affair had a woman's touch running all the way through it. Nothing was simple. The things that had happened were cruel, devious, and designed for lasting effect. Men didn't hold on to bodies, they disposed of them. They buried them in woods, or pushed them into rivers in cars, or put them under tons of concrete. They didn't make cured ham out of them and keep them in the shed. Male killers might keep trophies, but not whole cadavers. A recent experience with a friend had set her mind on this course. Her friend had found out that her husband was having an affair. She had packed his belongings into bin bags, dumped them outside on collection day, and had then gone on to carve the word arsehole into the bonnet of his prized possession, his car. Not only had her friend wanted to destroy her husband's most valued things, she had wanted him to know she had done it.
She had wanted him to feel the effects of her fury and relish his distress as a souvenir. Whoever had been at work in the Porter family had wanted the same, had wanted to see them suffer, and had wanted them